At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
It's not that we didn't have rules for Wall Street to live by. They just didn't cover all of Wall Street, which kind of explains why we are where we are, right? Today, the White House released its plan to fill in the gaps. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Cargill. Collaborate, create, succeed. This is how Cargill works with customers. Stories online at CargillCreates.com. And by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build stronger customer relationships through email marketing. ConstantContact.com.
From the studios of KERA in Dallas, Texas, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you with us on this Thursday. It is the 26th of March today. And maybe it's just me, but Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner keeps popping up in front of the House Financial Services Committee like he's got all the time in the world. Today, he was asking Congress to give regulators more power, new ways to drag what's been going on in a big chunk of the financial markets out of the shadows. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale reports now on the Obama administration's new rules of the road.
Under Secretary Geithner's plan, complex financial instruments would be traded on regulated exchanges. The SEC would require hedge funds to disclose their finances, and there would be an Uber regulator that could take over tottering giants. At today's hearing, Geithner said current government rules are no match for modern finance.
This crisis has made clear that large interconnected firms and markets need to be brought within a stronger and more conservative regulatory regime.
Some experts say deregulation spawned new forms of banking and risk-taking. Geithner says banks have evolved way beyond the old regulations. William Isaac is a former chairman of the FDIC. He says in 1980, regulated banks handled most commercial lending, and today it's less than a third.
So more and more of the business of banking is occurring outside of banking institutions. We have this elaborate safety net and regulatory system in place for our banks, but we didn't have anything in place for firms like AIG or other very large and important insurance companies or investment banks.
But the University of San Francisco's John Fisher says, watch out.
We thought that Sarbanes-Oxley legislation after the collapse of Enron and WorldCom was largely a good thing, and the unintended consequences are that it's extraordinarily difficult for U.S. companies to complete initial public offerings.
Fisher fears the unintended consequences of regulating new financial services could end up stifling growth. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Today's proposals came as no surprise to the industry they would affect most. Congress has been talking about tightening up on the shadow banking system for a while now. Of course, just because bankers know what's coming doesn't mean they have to like it. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson has more on the industry's reaction from New York.
Let's start with hedge funds. Right now, they're not required to register with the government. That's one thing that's almost certain to change. And Steve Thiel, who teaches securities regulation at Fordham Law School, says the industry expects that.
I don't think they're throwing up their hands and saying, do whatever you want. I think if the proposals were for aggressive regulation of their internal operations, they'd be very upset. But right now, the kind of regulation that's on the horizon for hedge funds is largely this kind of registration for the advisors.
When it comes to other steps the government might take, the industry is offering its own ideas. Non-binding, of course. The Managed Funds Association has for years offered a best practices guide for hedge funds. But Adam Larrick of the American Enterprise Institute says try as they might to push for self-regulation, it'll be hard to stop this train.
the hedge fund industry and the private equity industry clearly do not want to be regulated. At this point, I think what they're trying to do is just minimize the damage that it could cause.
Bob Pickle is the CEO of the International Swaps and Derivatives Association. He's still combing through the details, but he says he doesn't want the derivatives industry to be singled out for tougher regulation.
Whatever your view may be about credit default swaps in the current financial crisis, I think everyone has to acknowledge that the other derivatives have performed well.
Pickle says he'll be meeting with members and hopes to help shape comprehensive financial reform. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
There is a wide range of options open to Congress and the White House as they try to work out the details of these new regulations. Commentator and economist Susan Lee thinks one of those options is one too many.
One totally obvious thing has emerged from our current mess: the need for a better, smarter way to regulate the financial system. And the financial reform lobby has been furiously generating ideas. So far, there have been zillions of suggestions, and I've only heard one that stands out as nonsense: making the Federal Reserve into a super regulator over the entire financial system. It's easy to see why this idea is appealing. Right now, regulatory authority is divided among dozens of state and federal agencies. And so it's possible for someone like Bernie Madoff, whose business was regulated by three different entities, to elude detection. So maybe, just maybe, one regulatory superpower could nail criminal activity by individuals or even mischief by a single institution. But that's way different than the notion that one giant regulator can spot the beginning of systemic risk. The current Fed failed to cite a bunch of alarming problems that were occurring system-wide. It didn't notice the over-leveraged condition at many bank holding companies. It was oblivious to the bubble blowing up the real estate market. It ignored predatory lending practices. And it didn't recognize that a little oversight of the derivative markets was necessary. The problem simply is that a super regulator requires super people, people who have super foresight. And since no such people exist, pretending they do will only give us a false sense of security, and we'll feel betrayed the next time a crisis hits. If you doubt me, consider that the creation of the super regulator is being left to a collection of some of the least super people on the planet, the U.S. Congress. And at the head of this effort is Barney Frank, the same person who had the foresight to declare that the financial position of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac was absolutely solid. He made this declaration just weeks before those institutions collapsed into the hands of the federal government. I rest my case.
Susan Lee is an economist living in New York City. Down at the lower end of Manhattan today, not much rest at all. Call it a rally if you like. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There actually is such a thing as a food emergency, and it's a lot more serious than not having something in the house for dinner. Officially, it's when the government has to figure out which ingredient in a food is making people sick. To take just a recent example, contaminated peanuts. Companies do have to keep records about the ingredients they use, but according to a report out today, they are not keeping enough records. Marketplace's Janet Babin has more now from North Carolina Public Radio.
It can be a long road from the field to your fork. In the report, the government tried to track all the stops made by 40 foods. Daniel Levinson's the Inspector General of the Department of Health and Human Services.
Only 5 of the 40 products we purchased could actually be traced through each stage of the food supply chain.
A pretty disturbing discovery, especially because it's apparently not that hard to keep track of all the ingredients going into food. Manufacturer Mike Schall is with Monterey Gourmet Foods.
It's record keeping, it's observation, which is mandated by FDA.
Inspector General Levinson wants Congress to write tougher record keeping laws. That could raise costs for food companies. But Sarah Klein with Center for Science in the Public Interest says not necessarily.
It may cost businesses a little more money at the front end, but it will certainly save them the kind of money that they've been losing from these recalls.
Kellogg recently admitted that the peanut recall cost it more than $60 million. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
We'll be right back. Just last year, Iceland was officially the happiest place on the planet. That's how one survey in London described it. A high standard of living with among the best healthcare and education systems anywhere. Of course, that was before anybody figured out how to say subprime in Icelandic, I think. The global financial crisis crashed into the island last fall. Its three largest banks collapsed, owing more than 10 times what the whole economy was worth. So Iceland became the first developed country to ask for help from the International Monetary Fund in 30 years. We sent Stephen Beard to the capital, Reykjavik, to see how things are going 6 months later.
Icelandic tour guides usually take you to see volcanoes and geysers, but local author Andre Magnusson is showing me Borgarton Street, the site of a man-made disaster.
Yeah, we could call this street the Boulevard of Broken Dreams.
The street runs through the heart of Reykjavik's stricken financial district. It's lined with Iceland's busted banks.
Just here in front of us is the headquarters of Kaupthing, where capitalism fell in Iceland.
Iceland's three biggest banks borrowed and lent billions overseas. But when the credit crunch struck, the tiny Icelandic economy just wasn't big enough to bail them out. The crash hit the wider economy hard. The local currency fell 50% against the dollar. Unemployment has soared, and pretty soon, 1 in 10 will be out of a job.
Like Icelanders were all crazy about flat screens 1 year ago, they're now all crazy about going fishing and, making a living, survival.
Teitur Torkelsson runs an energy consultancy called FTO. His firm's income has been cut in half. Everywhere, he says, there are signs of a new austerity.
If you travel the country now, 6 months after the crash, you will stop at a gas station and the girl who's attending the gas station, she will be knitting socks. People are not spending, they're not eating as much out. So we're adjusting pretty fast.
It's not surprising that Icelanders feel poor. Thousands of Icelandic families now owe more than their assets are worth. 4-year-old Regina Djabjerg is cycling back from play school with her dad, Einar. Cheerfully, she chants, "We're going home." Einar is less enthusiastic about their 2-bedroom apartment. He bought it 3 years ago with a loan worth $100,000. But Icelandic loans are tied to the inflation rate. His mortgage is now $126,000. The crash of the currency last year pushed up the inflation rate sharply, pushing thousands of people into negative equity.
It's pure robbery because people that maybe owned 40% of their home, that percentage is gone now.
The bank is getting the equity in your home.
Yeah, the bank always wins. That's the rule, name of the game.
Having nationalised the banks, the government is now spending billions stabilising the currency and subsidising wages. 6 months ago, Iceland had no national debt. Now it's expected to be, proportionally, even more indebted than the United States. Einar blames Icelandic financiers.
They were praised in the media of being, the new Vikings. They go abroad and conquer the world, but they just raped and pillaged their own people.
In the satirical TV show Comedy Room, this spoof version of Candle in the Wind laments the passing of a nation, sunk under a tidal wave of corruption and greed. The crash is causing acute financial distress, but writer Andre Magnusson says he's glad that Iceland's career as an international financial centre is over.
What kind of an island will we become if everybody's working all day thinking of money, getting lots of money paid for thinking about money, spending their spare time wasting that money? We would not have become a very nice place, I think.
But will Icelanders really be content to return to being nice, knitting socks and swapping recipes for blood sausage? The search is now on for a business to replace high finance. In Reykjavik, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Coming up, what happens when recession hits Credit Card Central?
It used to be, well, how are things going? Oh, I'm so busy. I can't believe how busy I am. Now it's kind of like, well, I'm glad I have a job. There's a lot of anxiety that's kind of a subtext of everything that we do these days.
But first, let's do the numbers. Increased regulation, tighter curbs on risk-taking. You'd think Wall Street would be down in the dumps. Not a chance. The Dow Industrial surged 2.25% today. 174 points closed at 7,924. The Nasdaq bounced 3.75%, 58 points, finished at 1587. The S&P 500 jumped 1.9%, 15 points, ended at 829. Some good earnings numbers helped lift the markets today. Best Buy popped up 12.5%. ConAgra rose 9%. Research in Motion thumbed up nearly 5% today. General Motors revved up 14% on news that 7,500 employees had signed up for buyouts. Ford rose 6% on that news. There was plenty of demand for government bonds today. Investors snapped up $24 billion in seven-year notes. That quieted fears that demand for U.S. debt might be waning. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term financial goals at Vanguard.com. And by Palm Wonderful, 100% pomegranate juice in the curvy bottle, the antioxidant superpower. Information at pomwonderful.com. Keep an eye on Marketplace wherever you go. iPhone users can listen to business news and updates on fallout from the financial crisis, watch the Marketplace whiteboards, and follow the Scratchpad blog. Just visit marketplace.org on your iPhone.
On the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on personal income and spending for February. The University of Michigan releases its report on consumer sentiment for March. And the writer-director of the films Reservoir Dogs and Pulp Fiction, among others, has a birthday. Quentin Tarantino will be 46. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. So you grow up, you get a good job, marry, have a couple of kids, and buy a house. It's the American dream, right? But a lot of people got in trouble chasing that last part and helped take the economy down with them. In today's installment of Taking Stock, our series of occasional conversations with people who can give us the longer view of our economic situation, Columbia University economist Edmund Phelps and American attitudes toward home ownership. Phelps says that the dream of owning a house has been fueled in large part by the government.
Democrats and Republicans have been very keen to make home ownership almost a national purpose. President Clinton got through Congress a 1997 act to force mortgage lenders to relax the conditions on loans for low-income people. And then there were tax breaks on capital gains in houses in 1998. But I'd have to say that it isn't just public policy. The banks, which used to have something to do with business lending, sort of lost their expertise in that area, and they began to focus all their lending efforts on residential mortgages and other soft targets.
Let me ask you this, though, because if the government gets rid of the home mortgage interest deduction, I, for one, will be extremely annoyed, and so will the 70% of Americans who own their own homes. I mean, it would be a sea change in the way we look at homes in this country.
Yes, it would be, but to me it makes a lot of sense because, look, this is a very funny kind of asset in which the owner of the asset gets the services of the asset, the shelter and the comforts and so forth that the asset provides, and at the same time, as if the owner was paying income tax on those services, the owner gets to deduct the mortgage cost.
Is that a bad thing? I mean,
to me, that's quite crazy. There are only two logical ways to go. One is to deny mortgage interest deductibility because no tax is being paid on the benefits, or start taxing the benefits.
You're a renter, aren't you?
I am a renter. You've caught me. But that's not why I have these positions. It just happens that I'm a renter.
Well, you know, and you live in New York City, it can be tough to own, right?
Lots of us here in New York City are renters, yes. We're a very strange breed.
Well, you know, even though you've made peace with the idea of renting, for a lot of people, it is a dirty word out there. I mean, you have to make the rent every single month, and you're just giving this check over to the landlord, and you're not getting anything out of it.
do me a favor and weigh the pros and cons of renting or not.
If you rent, that's it. You don't have to pay any interest to anybody. You don't have to pay any maintenance costs to anybody. You don't have to worry about whether the boiler is going to break down. While if you own your own home, you have 100 aggravations. Maybe the roof will leak while you're overseas. In strict money terms, there is no reason to think there's a systematic, long-run, sustainable, durable difference between the two.
Is this homeownership obsession that we've had, has it affected the rest of our economic lives? Does it change the way we save? Does it change the way we spend in other regards?
Of course, while house prices were going up, that became a substitute for saving. People would refinance their homes, take the profit and spend that, hoping that prices would go up again, and they'd do the same thing and spend that. But I do think that this homeownership craze does tie in with a newfound fashion for spending rather than saving. I'm old enough to remember in the 1930s and 1940s when thrift, frugality, was considered an important virtue. In those days, we all knew Benjamin Franklin's aphorism, a penny saved is a penny earned. Today, the official doctrine seems to be that a penny spent is a penny earned.
Do you think, Professor, that there is a way for us to change the housing paradigm in this country, that it is the American dream, and if you have the material means, you ought to buy a house?
I'm hoping that the administration and other thought leaders will succeed eventually in bringing the country back to the older idea that the American dream is having a career, getting a job, and getting involved in it and doing well in it. That was the core of the good life. That's what we have to get back to and get away from this mystique that the most important thing in your life that could ever happen to you is to be a homeowner.
Edmund Phelps at Columbia University. Thanks so much for your time.
You're welcome. Good to be here.
Edmund Phelps won the Nobel Memorial Prize in Economics in 2006. He is the director of Columbia University's Center on Capitalism and Society. And he has plenty of other thoughts on the current crisis. You can read them at marketplace.org. We've all got our hands full dealing with a recession and financial crisis brought on by millions of mortgages going bad. But out there in the future somewhere might be another credit-induced problem, thanks to those little pieces of plastic we all carry around in our wallets. Yesterday, we took you to Sioux Falls, South Dakota, and explained how a change in lending laws there brought banks and their credit card businesses running, millions of bills and applications going out, billions of dollars in payments coming in to processing centers that needed thousands of workers. Now, though, it's payback time for Americans who binged on plastic and for the industry that fed their addiction. In part two of her series on the town that credit built, Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith has a look at how the credit crisis is hitting Sioux Falls.
On a frigid South Dakota morning, dozens of people file into the local community college. They're here to take a class on how to find a job.
Good morning. Are you here for the job search assistance class? I'm Greg.
Greg Johnson is with the South Dakota Department of Labor. He used to offer this class once a month. Now he's running four classes a week for hundreds of job seekers.
Sioux Falls, up until a few months ago, was a super strong place for employment. Employers constantly clamored for more employees, more employees.
Banks needed them to work in the booming credit card industry. Citibank, Wells Fargo, HSBC, and dozens of others began moving their card operations to Sioux Falls in the 80s. They wanted to take advantage of the state's lax usury laws, which let banks charge whatever interest rates they wanted on credit cards. Banks jacked up their rates, and plastic became their main profit engine. Sioux Falls was transformed from a meatpacking town into the credit card industry's back office. University of South Dakota economist Ralph Brown.
From 1980 to 2008, its population has increased by 67%. Job growth has been even faster than that.
The more debt the country took on, the more work there was in Sioux Falls. Financial services now account for 17,000 jobs in the city. That's 15% of the population. But times are changing. debt-heavy Americans can't pay their credit card bills, default rates are soaring, and banks are starting to lose money on plastic. Again, economist Ralph Brown.
We've seen many job cuts, and we think there will be a basic resizing of the financial industry. So that's a concern for Sioux Falls.
It seemed like we had kind of missed it, and then all of a sudden we got hit real hard.
That's Kathy. She lost her job as a bank administrator in December when Citibank laid off 200 people in its Sioux Falls office.
I've applied at different places, but I haven't seen really a whole lot of openings. And the competition is so great, it's hard to know if you're going to be the one that stands out.
To stand out, Kathy's taking the Labor Department's job search class. She wants to fine-tune her resume and get some interviewing tips.
And employers are looking at attitude more importantly than education and experience. The more often I have a good attitude, the more often I have a good day.
Faking a good attitude is new territory for Sioux Falls, which has had one of the lowest unemployment rates in the country for years.
Suddenly we start to know people who have been laid off, and that's not supposed to happen around here.
So Brian Bierke has lived in Sioux Falls for more than 30 years. Over a piece of chocolate silk pie at the Phillips Avenue Diner, he says his marketing firm has taken a hit, and so has every other local business.
It used to be, well, how are things going? Oh, I'm so busy. I can't believe how busy I am. Now it's kind of like, well, I'm glad I have a job. There's a lot of anxiety that's kind of a subtext of everything that we do these days.
Sioux Falls has already seen its unemployment rate double. Still, economist Ralph Brown says the city is resilient.
Yeah, we've got a rough year or two ahead of us, but in my view, Sioux Falls will recover.
Brown points out that healthcare now employs just as many people as financial services, but even that shift owes a debt to the credit card business. 2 years ago, local entrepreneur Denny Sanford donated $400 million to the local hospital. It was the biggest gift ever to a healthcare facility, and it's turning Sioux Falls into a major medical center. Owen Sanford, he made his money in the credit card business. In Sioux Falls, South Dakota, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing absolute return funds for all kinds of investors. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note today, and I don't know whether to tip my hat or shake my head at this one, but Kentucky Fried Chicken is taking to the streets of its hometown, Louisville, Kentucky. And I mean it when I say that. The company is filling in potholes all over town in return for being allowed to rebrand the patches as saying refreshed by KFC. It's a tagline from their new ad campaign, I guess. Apparently, what's called public service advertising is all the rage. This past Christmas was the third year in a row that the good people at Charmin provided a public restroom in Times Square. Charmin, restroom. Anyway, that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow gained 2.25%, 174 points. The NASDAQ bounced 3.75%, 58 points. The S&P 500 jumped 1.9%, 15 points. John Buckley, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Thanks today to the staff here at KERA. Coming up next time on the program, back home in Los Angeles, it's back to Iceland, where they're banking on a national pastime.
We have one of the best fishing grounds in the world. We always come back to this. I mean, it is what we know best. Probably it's at least in part what will get us out of this crisis.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.